From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the neighborhoods of southern Louisville. As reported by the Louisville Courier-Journal, if you were to walk down the streets, you'd see signs of revitalization. A mural welcoming visitors in a number of languages. A Caribbean cafe with an open sign. A vacant grocery store with the Rent Me placard in the window. Local residents told their newspaper they want to see their neighborhood thrive, but it's mixed. There's still a long way to go. And to help achieve their vision, residents are submitting their ideas to a group of acclaimed urban designers. They've been collecting feedback since early this year, and in June, they're going to share what they've learned with local agencies who can use them to shape development projects. This kind of consultation work would normally cost maybe $400,000, but the designers did this work pro bono, and they're with an organization called the Congress for New Urbanism. Lynn Richards is CEO and president of that group, and she's originally from Rochester. She now works with communities across the country to achieve the goals of the new urbanism movement. Among them are creating complete, compact, and connected spaces without gentrifying them. That's a goal for many people in Rochester neighborhoods as well. You've heard conversations about development without displacement on this program in recent weeks, and this hour we expand on those conversations with Lynn Richards. She'll be in town next week for a luncheon presentation that's part of the Reshaping Rochester series. But first, she joins us on Connections to discuss how she sees Rochester perhaps in the new urbanism movement and what our city can learn from other communities across the country. So let's welcome our guest. Lynn Richards is on the line with us, a Rochester native. So welcome back, at least via phone. How are you?
Thank you, Evan, so much for having me on the show. It's wonderful to be on WXXI. I grew up with WXXI, so it's always been a little bit of a bucket list for me to be on your program.
We are happy to fulfill it for you. And with us here in studio, Maria Fergiuelli is Executive Director of the Community Design Center of Rochester. Welcome back.
Thank you, Evan.
And also with us is Howard Decker, who is an author, architect, and board member for the Community Design Center. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan. It's good to be here.
You know, Lynn, I was telling our guests in studio before the hour began that I'm probably like a lot of listeners when they hear the term Congress for the New Urbanism. That's probably about 3 years old. That's probably a new thing. Not so much.
No, we were actually founded in the early 1990s. So we are a 27-year-old organization. We have international chapters in about 9 different countries. We have members from every single state in the United States. And once a year, we gather when what we call a Congress. This year, it's in Louisville. And we have representatives, as I said, from just about every state and about 3 dozen countries, folks from three dozen countries kind of come in. So we've been around for a while.
And tell us what the mission of the Congress for New Urbanism is. If you're sort of in that elevator pitch situation, what are you guys doing? What are you trying to accomplish?
What I often say at dinner parties is I work for an organization that seeks to create walkable, livable places that gives you a choice on where and how to work, shop, play, and get around. Nobody gets up in the morning saying, oh, please, please, I want to spend 3 hours in my car. Everybody gets up in the morning and says, how can I get through my day in the most enjoyable and effective and efficient way? How can I structure my day where it's the least amount of hassle? How can I structure my day where I have joy and happiness? And isn't that what we all want to achieve? And as you rightly pointed out in your introduction, what's happening now, it's actually not happening now, but the big issue that's being addressed is how can we revitalize neighborhoods and corridors that have seen decades of disinvestment, and to do it in a way that minimizes displacement and increases access to opportunity for all the legacy residents. And that's the real crutch that we're working on now.
Well, tell us a little bit about what you remember growing up in Rochester.
No, my gosh. Well, I spent my, I lived in the city. I went to Allendale, Columbia, graduated, and I spent my time actually biking everywhere. I was in softball practice in Webster. I would bike to school. It was about 10 miles. I'm still an avid cyclist. I would go down to the lake. I mean, the lake is just beautiful. I had 2 paper routes. My mom is an artist, and she had one of her first studios on East Main Street in the Fetters Building, which was occupied by artists at the time. So in some ways, it was one of Rochester's first maker spaces. Anywho, I just grew up kind of biking around and taking transit everywhere and just enjoying the city. I think Rochester's fantastic. Of course, go to the farmer's market on Saturday morning. Who doesn't love to do that? So I have a real warm spot in my heart for Rochester, but not your weather.
Well, and Howard and Marie, it's been a little while for Lynn to kind of get reacquainted with Rochester. She's going to be here. Let our listeners know what you have coming up here, Maria.
Yes, Lynn will be our featured speaker at our Reshaping Rochester luncheon, May 22nd, so next Wednesday. She will be capping off a series of speakers. We have 5 lectures in the series, and those are 4 evening lectures, and then, of course, our business luncheon next weekend. So we hope that you'll be able to attend.
All right, tickets are available now, and if you go to the website rrcdc.org, you can find the Reshaping Rochester series there. Again, the event 1 week from today, the lunch event at the Memorial Art Gallery. For Lynn's conversation there. And Howard, there's a lot of different directions she could take this. What are you hoping to hear from Lynn Richards?
Well, you know, we're always looking for opportunities to learn, to have teachable moments. And I hope Lynn brings plenty of teachable moments with her so that she remembers to tell us about Chattanooga or Louisville, where things are happening, or Grand Rapids or Columbus or other cities that she is working in, that where things are happening in a wonderful way. That perhaps will transfer to our circumstances here in Rochester.
Later this week, Lynn, we're going to have a conversation with our colleague Brett Dahlberg and some of his outstanding recent reporting he did. That'll be on Friday. We'll have that conversation. One of our reporters spent weeks with a camera on his bike. He bicycles to and from work quite often. He bicycles around Rochester. He recorded just about everything to kind of get interactions, to check out who was parked in the bike lanes, which turns out is just about everybody, including sometimes, the Rochester Police Department. And then the question of the interactions as a bicyclist with motorists, and had some very, very rough interactions there. And then got some marginal reasons why things weren't a little bit better, though I know there are people like Eric Frisch and some wonderful people for the city of Rochester who are working on not just bike lanes, but infrastructure, cultural changes. But it's still hard here for bicyclists, and we're going to talk about that on Friday. So, Lynn, that is just one small slice of what it is like in a city that is trying to be more multimodal. Where is it working? Point to a city where you would say, oh, man, if you could show up there tomorrow, wait till you walk around, bicycle around, the culture's changing. Where is it working?
That's a great question, and it's probably the number one question I get asked all the time, and you're not going to like my answer because I would say no place, which isn't to throw all of the cities in the United States under the bus, but it's rather to say that this is a process. It's a growing evolution, and while some cities have made huge strides, there's still incredible room for improvement. So I biked in this morning. I'm in Washington, D.C., and I've, as I said, I've been a biker my whole life. I've been commuting to work in the D.C. area for about 20 years, and yes, it has gotten a lot better, yet still this morning, I had a car and actually a truck with a big trailer cut me off when I was in a painted, protected cycle track, and I have a horn, and I leaned on my horn, and he starts yelling at me, and so every city that has made enormous strides can still do better. There's still a long ways to go. And that's not anything to be ashamed to say. When we're talking about creating and evolving cities with a whole bunch of different needs and desires and different personalities, not only at the political, but with the stakeholders, creating that balance between all modes of transit is going to be a challenge. Even in Amsterdam and in Denmark, which are two, Amsterdam and Copenhagen, two cities that people often hold up as nirvana, there's still problems there, having biked through both Amsterdam and Copenhagen recently. I was just in Melbourne, Australia, which for 7 years running is deemed the most livable city in the world. And they brought me in to say, okay, how can we do this better? There's always room for improvement. There's always room to kind of make it a little bit better, which is why it's so important for cities just to start. Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. You want a bike lane in your downtown, your town down, just start it there, and then we can begin to link up all the different pieces of infrastructure. We want to revitalize the waterfront. How can we do that incrementally? And I think that that has been lost. This idea of incremental improvement has been lost over the recent decades under the guise of these huge infrastructure projects. Don't get me wrong, I'm a huge fan of what Rochester is doing with filling in the inner loop and reconnecting those neighborhoods, but that's a big project. And when city leaders or even state leaders begin to think about what they can do, you think big. But how can we structure, what can the city do to structure and empower and encourage small incremental improvements? Because it's going to take both the larger projects that the city is doing on Riverwalk, as well as more incremental improvements, such as bike lane improvements.
Okay, Howard?
And I think if we can, when Lynn comes, it'll be a great moment when we can take a message about walkable, dense, mixed-use city life and help to create in people's minds an image or a set of ideas about what that would be like and why that's an important idea. As Lynn says, the struggle to create a neighborhood that where the school is perhaps the center of life and there's a grocer and a saloon and a butcher and all the kinds of things you need, and it's all within a quarter of a mile of your home. That's a kind of wonderful idea that could animate all kinds of things, not just big picture things like filling in the inner loop, which is a great gesture, but also much more incremental things. And we need everyone to have this idea in their heads so that when the developers go to build something or when consumers go to look at something possibly to rent or to buy, they're all thinking, you know, this is what I want. I want it to be mixed use. I want it to be walkable. I want it to be dense. I want it to have all the things I need within a short radius of my home. And if we can get that image to be more widely understood across the larger community, it would be great, because then the little things start to fall in place as well, as Lynn is suggesting.
You want to add to that, Maria?
Yeah, and Howard, you say it's an idea, and to me, I think it's more than an idea. It's actually a quality of life issue. And when you look at some of our most challenged neighborhoods, it's absolutely critical for their ability to improve the quality of their lives. If they're able to be reliant on their own transportation to access their jobs, their education, to run their day-to-day errands, then they don't have to worry about the bus not running on Sundays or any number of other things, having to travel very, very far to get groceries. So it's critically important for improving the quality of life for our most marginalized populations. Mm.
So in our second half hour, we're going to talk a little bit about the theme of what it means to create a great place, not a great new building or attract a big new business, but what placemaking and sort of great community placemaking entails. Because as Lynn says, you know, cities around the country are all sort of trying to crack this code, and our guests will have a lot to say about that. I do want to divert a little bit here and ask Lynn a few things about your career that lead me to wonder if politics makes this harder. Here's why I ask that. You've done work for the EPA in 2016. You wrote a little bit about why a Trump administration might make things harder for the new urbanism movement. And I want to resist this idea that new urbanism is political. But in this country, who's more likely to resist fuel efficiency standards? Who is more likely to advocate for multimodal transportation planning and usage? Who is more likely to live in dense urban areas, and who's more likely to not? And it starts to feel like it has become a partisan or a political thing. And I wish it weren't that way. And I'd love for you to disabuse me of that, but I'm not sure you can, Lynn. I mean, is this political now?
I actually am a firm believer that where and how cities are designed and built is apolitical. And in fact, there's a lot of examples to that. Nick Corment, who's the former mayor of Oklahoma City, is a Republican and very supportive of this. I've recently been on the Hill talking with both Republican and Democrat senators and House representatives on different infrastructure bills that they're working on, and there's complete agreement. And a small clarification, since we are on radio and we can't edit it out, the 2016 article I wrote actually was not that Trump was going to make it more difficult for new urbanism. It was actually just the opposite, that a lot of the work, both in the smart growth and the new urbanist movement over the last almost three decades, has seen a range of political leadership. And at every step of the way, there is a way forward. And the reason why is that it comes down to economic development. So, yes, not everybody wants to live in a more urban neighborhood. Absolutely. When you look at the preference surveys that have been done over the last 20 years, whether it's done by a more right-leaning group or a more left-leaning group, you know, there have been 20 or 30 of these, and the results are consistently the same, that about 50% of the population wants to live in a more compact urban neighborhood, and about 50% of the population wants to live in a more low-density suburban neighborhood. All right, fine. So this is what the preference are. The market, however, is responding with just about 5% of the product that is more compact mixed use in the ways that we've been discussing on the show. So that's the delta. We're not trying to shift everyone to live in a more complete neighborhood. It's entirely their choice. But let's embrace the market forces. Let's align our codes and our financing so as not to subsidize and to preference more low density suburban development, but instead create a level playing field so the market can respond equally. So again, I have found that across the board, I have worked with Republican mayors, Republican governors, across the board. And the reason why they want to embrace this type of development is for the economic bottom line. Because study after study after study has consistently demonstrated that when you build in a more compact, complete neighborhood style of development, you're going to have a higher return on those infrastructure investments. So that's why increasingly city leaders are embracing this type of development for their economic bottom line.
All right, so let me just go ahead and I'm going to quote from your writing in 2016, and that way I can be a little more square because no, it's fair. I think it's more nuanced than I laid out, but at the same time, here's what you wrote. You wrote in 2016, under President Obama, federal agencies like HUD, DOT, and EPA expanded their work on sustainable communities, especially through the Partnership for Sustainable Communities. These programs have long been a target for congressional Republicans. From 2009 to 2012, I had to defend the EPA's Office of Sustainable Communities against elimination-minded officials arguing that its core goals had been sufficiently incorporated. Unfortunately, these programs are likely to be eliminated. One silver lining in their elimination may be how other federal agencies absorb the staff talent from these excellent programs. Already, Republican leadership has discussed a federal hiring freeze and 10% workforce reduction, meaning that dozens of leading experts on community design and development will move to new positions within their agencies. This presents an opportunity. How can we take advantage of these urbanist connections in new federal program areas? Finally, keep in mind that Trump will likely draw federal appointees from previous Republican administrations. This could be good for our work, end quote. So fair enough. It just sounds like it sounds like the good news is more incidental or accidental currently as opposed to intentional. Is that fair?
Well, I mean, we have seen those hiring freezes, of course, and a lot of what I wrote certainly came to pass. But again, what we're and the political climate within federal agencies, I don't think has been quite as supportive of a new urbanist or sustainable development agenda. But in every crisis, there's an opportunity. And so the opportunity here is not necessarily to rely so much on the federal government and the funding programs that were evident both under Bush and under Obama, but instead look to see how state governments and city governments can take back more control and create the cities and states that they want to see. You know, Governor Cuomo just recently announced a design competition for removing the Skyway in Buffalo, mm-hmm. New York, as a for example. So we're seeing states and cities really step up to the plate in ways where the federal government perhaps has constricted. And again, I see this as an amazing opportunity, because when we talk about strategies to create place, to create these complete neighborhoods that we've been talking about, it's not a one size fits all. We have to break it down into the elevator speech, as you said, of, you know, that's why I say walkable, livable communities. But how do you do that on East Main Street in Rochester, New York, is going to be very different than how you do it on Columbia Pike in Arlington, Virginia. While you may have the values of the outcomes that we want to achieve, how we do it is going to be dependent upon what are the needs of the neighborhood, what are the stakeholders saying, what are the local codes and ordinances dictate. So I, for one, am thinking that there's an opportunity, and this is what CNU has been doing, a real opportunity to better engage with city leaders and with state leaders to help support the outcomes that we want to see across their cities and states.
And so let me turn to Howard Decker, and sorry, Howard, I'm just going to ask you this, and I don't say this at all to lampoon anyone with ideas that are different from yours, etc., but I want to ask you, if you're at a dinner party and you're talking about, you know, how much you don't love automobiles, or your concerns about our society being structured to be dominated by cars, if there is someone who thinks, oh, come on, you're crazy, do you feel like you can guess their politics?
Yes. almost certainly I can. And the big opportunity, to use Lynn's word, the big opportunity here is to try and craft our cities so that they're fit places for our futures and for the futures of our children and our grandchildren. And certainly one central aspect of that has to do with sustainability and resilience. And what makes a community sustainable? Well, in the old days, Rochester was very sustainable because there were not very many cars, and we had streetcars, mm-hmm. and we walked. And we had, as a result, we had neighborhoods that were dense, and everything was more or less within reach. You could kind of easily get to where you needed to go in each hub or core zone of the city. And that promoted a very high quality of life. That's what people in Vienna, that was the city that was voted the highest quality of life in the world this year, or Melbourne, or wherever. This is what these citizens see as promoting the highest quality of life. So the big opportunity is to make our cities more sustainable through devices which are articulated by the Congress for New Urbanism.
And thinking about our kids and grandkids, that does appeal to everybody. I mean, we ought to be able to cross all kinds of divides.
It does. And the two good, here's the kind of yin and yang of this. The development community in Rochester is increasingly building mixed-use developments where you have a shop and perhaps a place to work and a place to live, more or less all in the same building. And that's a good new direction for development in our city. And lots of different developers seem to be doing the same thing. On the other hand, this is the United States that just pulled out of the sustainability treaties. And so, yes, the opportunity is enormous. And I think it's a little more polarized, perhaps, than we might want to make it seem. But it's pretty... I think there's a lot of politics in this.
Okay. And so, Lynn, if you're at that party that you describe and you tell people what you do with the Center for New Urbanism, and one person says, well, that sounds wonderful, we need more of that, and the next person says, that's a screwy idea, you don't think you can guess their politics?
Well, I will say I've been in exactly those conversations. And then the other, I'm a mom. My son's 16. So I've been, you know, at these dinner parties with my parents of my son's friends, outside of my work areas. And I will say the needs that you have when you are a parent are different than when you are a 20-something or when you're an empty nester. So to further complicate it and to make it harder, Evan, for you to pin me down, I will say I have talked to many Democratic mothers, and I know their politics. I spot on know it, and they're like, I'm not giving up my car, which is why I think we need to frame this as transportation fluency. You know, I have a car. I like my car. I drive my car. I much prefer biking to work. It's my preference. Why can't we create neighborhoods where folks have choices on how to get around.
Doesn't it always seem to come back to the car? Somehow we always come back to cars. And I'm laughing, Lynn, because Evan and Maria and I have spent lots of time talking about cars, and it's well known that I'm an articulate foe of cars here in Rochester. But it does come down to that. If we can get them out of our lives as being the only or principal central focus of our lives, if we can get the car out of that central focus, we could probably make better neighborhoods.
And here's why I asked Lynn and Howard this. This is why I think this matters here. I think there's a lot more common ground. And part of my job, I don't have a lot of skills in this world, part of my job is to find where there's common ground where people don't think they have it. Mm-hmm. These questions are not meant to divide people. It's meant to sort of observe the current landscape and then ask, is there more common ground? Do we have common values that we can share here that might unite the goals? You're not going to get everybody to agree on this, and everybody doesn't have to agree on this. But what I am observing is politically, you know, to Lynn and Howard's point, Republicans are more likely to just be honest and say, I'm not really interested in that. Democrats are more likely to say, that sounds great, and then do nothing to actually support it.
And that's why it's a steep slope.
I know. That's why it's very interesting. It's a very, very interesting divide right now. But let's set politics aside. Let's take our only break of the hour. When we come back, we're going to start with a question for Lynn from Chris, who writes to us on Twitter and says, Chris just says, I spent a week exploring Louisville, and I've never seen so many people walking everywhere. It was remarkable. But he's asking Lynn, what is the most common hurdle for public buy-in to get this to happen? Is it culture change? Is it financing? What are those biggest public hurdles to get there? And we'll get Lynn's take on that. And then we'll talk more about what placemaking is like, what it means to make a great place, not just make a great building or a great block, but to make places that we want to be in our communities. We're talking on the phone with Lynn Richards, who's the president and CEO for the Congress for New Urbanism, and she is coming to Rochester. She's a Rochesterian, by the way, a native Rochesterian, coming back to her hometown in a week, May 22nd, starting at 11:30 at the Memorial Art Gallery. There is an event, a luncheon presentation with Lynn on creating great places, a tool for economic development. It's all part of the Community Design Center of Rochester's Reshaping Rochester series. And if you want tickets, you can get them right now at rrcdc.org. Howard Decker and Maria Frigiuelli are here from the center, and we'll take that break and come right back next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on the Next Connections, Uber workers just completed a strike. They want better pay, better conditions. Do you use Uber and Lyft? Have you thought about what they get paid? Would you think about changing your mind, or do you think that's the way of the future? We'll talk about it Thursday. Then in our second hour, Hamilton just concluded its Rochester run. How accurate was the musical, and should we care? Talk with you Thursday. All right, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Thanks for joining us on this Wednesday afternoon. So Lynn Richards, Chris wants to know, after observing, for example, Louisville, where he said he was just blown away to see so many people walking, kind of a true experience that a lot of us are envisioning. And to your point, it's not perfect. There's no place that's sort of the perfect ideal right now. But he's wondering, what is the hurdle? What's the most common hurdle to get public buy-in for this? What would you say to that?
Fear. Look, I've been talking this whole time, and now I have a one-word answer. But it's fear. I fundamentally believe the reason why we are not moving faster towards the developing communities and neighborhoods that so many people say that they want, and there's funding, et cetera, is fear. It's fear at the stakeholder level that I don't want to change. I know how my life works now. It's fear at the local government level of I don't want to change. I don't want to go out and take a risk. If you don't have a lot of examples of how a complete neighborhood can operate, where you have opportunities to live, work, shop, play, get around in the way that Howard was describing earlier, what's holding you back? And 9 times out of 10, it's fear. And so what happens in these community meetings is the consultants, folks like myself, I'll throw myself under the bus here, will then talk about the technical solutions, then we'll talk about the research. The local government folks will talk about something else, you know, the financing of it. But I think that as a movement, we need to just sit in that space and acknowledge what that fear is and to put that on the table and then talk about it and to have a conversation. And in those community meetings where I have been able to do that, that's where you see real change occurring. There are a lot of technical strategies of how you can have those conversations. Tactical urbanism is a great example. I don't want to change my road. I don't want to put in a bike lane. What's going to happen? There's going to be a lot of traffic. Okay, well, let's try it for a weekend, and folks come out and, you know, we'll build a bike lane out of hay bales and whatnot. You can begin to experience it. So there's a lot of techniques, but I feel that the number one barrier that we're facing right now is fear. And that's political will, and that's also at the stakeholder level.
Okay, Maria, you agree?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, there's we spent so much time talking about the car, but because the car impacts space so much, and we have to, as has been stated, create other options so that people have choices. I guess that's why we always come back to the car. But we never talk about the benefits to the driver and the fact that having more people off the road provides tremendous benefits to other people. So, yeah, we'd love to do a better job of educating people about those particular places where we are seeing success so that we can point to those places whenever we're in these community meetings to say, look, why don't you try this, even if it's a temporary measure. So it'd be great.
And I think also we have some drawings on our gallery walls at the Design Center that were that come from the Congress for New Urbanism that show configurations in the city that we all understand, strip centers, for example. And they show a before, and there's the strip center with all the parking in front, and it looks like, you know, icky and not what we really would love to see. And then the next drawing shows how to fix that. And that fix doesn't require people to give up their cars. That fix doesn't require people to, it doesn't require the Democratic soccer moms that Lynn was talking about a few minutes ago. It doesn't require them to not be able to move or do what they need to do for their kids. It's a different image. It's a different idea about how things get configured. And I think that is another tool that's available to us to help overcome the fear that Lynn is describing, that what we're really after in the end is to make people totally change their lives. Not necessary. We just need to reconfigure things.
Yeah, and so let's talk a little bit about placemaking. I think about the trip I was on a year ago. Right now, the WXXI Travel Club is in Croatia. I am not, of course. I'm sitting right here. I wasn't invited this year. Maybe I didn't do a good enough job moving bags last year and being a good helper. But I was in Spain with the WXXI Travel Club a year ago. And one of the days, first of all, whenever you travel around Europe, you notice that most of these cities, there is sort of an old town and a new town. And the old town is very often no automobiles at all. You've got to park somewhere and get in there by foot or other form of transportation. And it's just lovely. So we were in San Sebastian with the WXXI Travel Club. And we were in the old part of town, sort of the old city, and just walking everywhere, eating on the street, having just a wonderful afternoon. And then before dinner, you know, we had a few hours free, and I was with a group of WXXI members, and we were thinking, you know, well, we could taxi back, but let's just walk. Let's walk out of the old city, into the new city, down to the beaches, all the way to the other part of town where our hotel was. And we walked a long way, but it was actually easy, even when we got out of the old city. Because even with their main sort of thoroughfares, I remember going under this tunnel, but there was a tunnel for the cars, and then there was a tunnel for the bikes and the pedestrians separate, but parallel to that, built for that. So you didn't have to compete with any of the space. You didn't have to fear for your life in the same way that Brett Dahlberg, our colleague, was just riding around Rochester. That infrastructure was there in the old city and the new city, recognizing the value. And as a consequence, people were still walking old city and new city, and every little neighborhood had its own personality. Mm-hmm. The little shops, the people, you know, we were asking about restaurants, I remember, and at this little candy shop, the owner, and then two people came in who were regular customers, and they were just very concerned with making sure they chose the right place for us. And they spent about 5 minutes debating this. It was just fascinating. But there were places, it just felt like there were places and personalities everywhere. Lynn, how do we create that? What is the key to placemaking as you see it in communities like Rochester that want to not just develop, not just have a new business come in, not just have a storefront, but have places?
So that's a great question. I'm going to pivot a little bit to answer it more broadly, then I'll get specific. But when you look at cities that have, as Howard pointed out earlier, a history or a culture of streetcars, those cities that had streetcars in the teens, 20s, 30s, and 40s are much easier to redevelop for a pedestrian-supportive experience because of the gridded streets and the housing stock of the building. So that's one thing to keep in mind, that those cities with that history of a streetcar grid are easier to revitalize than, say, the newer cities of, say, Houston, for example, though Houston is certainly making strides. So that's one kind of characteristic to keep in mind. Now, Rochester has that streetcar grid. You guys have an amazing housing stock. You have a lot of great neighborhood streets. I've been all over the city. Granted, it was several decades ago, but I remember what is there and what you can build off, which is the very first lesson that I would say is identify your assets and leverage those assets. Rochester is an amazing city. It has 8 universities, colleges and universities. It's economically stable. Yes, I know that Bausch & Lomb picked up and went home. Xerox has diminished. And of course, Kodak is just a shell of its former self right now. But think of all of the assets around which you can leverage in terms of the river, the public market, the great street grid, the housing stock, the natural amenity of Lake Ontario. When you want to create interesting neighborhoods, you build off of the assets that you have. Chicago, for example, everyone says that Chicago is such a great city. And what makes Chicago a great city are the individual neighborhoods and the characteristics and the uniqueness of each neighborhood and how they're connected by both biking and walking. You can have that same kind of experience. It's spread out, of course, a little bit more than what you might find in Spain, but you have those characteristics. So I'll let Howard and Maria jump in.
I would just say that it's very interesting that you talked about Spain, Evan, and Lynn is offering some other kinds of examples of where it works and how it works. If you stop and think about it, probably WXXI's Travel Club doesn't want to go to Jefferson Road in Henrietta for a 2-week vacation.
It's illegal to walk there.
Yeah,
yes,
for that reason, among many reasons.
Yeah.
And probably they do want to pick places where they can walk and experience a mixed, diverse kind of place. And so one of the things that we need to ask ourselves is, why would people want to come here? What would keep them here? And what kind of place can we make that really is a kind of best expression of urban life here in Rochester, New York, even when it gets cold outside? What is the best kind of urban life we can create in our city? And use that as a kind of roadmap, if you will, for our continuing redevelopment of the city. And then simultaneously look at the stuff that we really don't care that much about, that we probably wouldn't go to if we didn't have to, and not use that as a guide, but to use the other image as a guide. And that might help.
Okay, Maria?
Well, I always use an example. We always talk about, the fact that people don't walk here in Rochester. And, people will walk any distance, as you just said, when they're engaged and when there's something interesting, when there's a good experience. So, with the festivals we have in town, people will park their car. They'll take a bus to the location, then they walk the whole length of Park Avenue and back, and yet they'll take that little shuttle back to their car that's a few blocks away. But the reason is that we just don't have an engaging pedestrian experience. We need that continuous edge to the public realm, and all of those buildings that have been torn down to create surface parking lots really need to be replaced to create that interesting space that will make walking an engaging experience.
Sarah on Twitter says, the disappearance of the neighborhood grocery store has to be a huge impediment to walkable neighborhoods. Lynn Richards, do you agree?
I think Sarah's right in that we need to have destinations to walk to. So if you are in a neighborhood that is just residential and there is no destination, whether it is a grocery store, a bar, a civic, a public library, you don't have a lot of incentive to replace a car trip with a walking trip. So that's one response. Additionally, particularly in underserved communities that have food deserts, we need to increase the access to healthy food, particularly in underserved communities. So I think it's a little bit more nuanced than that. But the goal, as Howard has said several times, is creating these complete neighborhoods where you have a wide range of different jobs that you can do, just not the lower level service industry, that you have places that you can shop for your, you know, a hardware store, you know, a grocery store, for example. And it doesn't all have to be within, and I'm going to get in trouble now with my members, within a quarter of a mile. I think that can be very difficult to achieve, but it's very possible to achieve if that is all within, say, a half a mile or a mile. I think, folks, if you make it an interesting walk, if you make it safe, if you have different options of moving through that mile, biking, walking, transit, that's where we're going to see those complete neighborhoods come about.
Okay. Howard, Maria?
Well, I think let's think about it like this for a moment. One of the things that Americans value, and one of the reasons why so many Americans are staunch defenders of their cars, God bless them, is that we always talk about we have to have choice. And having choices is very important. And the car enables us to have as many choices as possible for where we work, where we shop, where we play, where our kids go to school. And we need the car for those choices. Now, for a moment, just as a kind of experiment, as a thought experiment, let's for a moment say, okay, you are going to live in a place where you need to have all of those choices, where to live, where to work, where to play, where to go to school, so on, but you can't get in a car. Ah, now all of a sudden we're making the kind of dense, walkable, mixed-use cities that all of us are talking about. And the matter of, and as a matter of choice, if those kinds of things were available to us in our neighborhoods, then you might see more of us on the sidewalk and less of us in the garage.
Maria?
Howard is exactly right. The planning industry over the last 4, 5, 6, 7 decades has thought about neighborhoods of how to get cars from point A to point B. Right. It's how to get cars, not people. We have forgotten how that it's not about getting the cars from point A to point B. It's about getting people from point A to point B. Google now is partnering with San Jose, California, to create a community of 20,000 people that doesn't have cars. They will have cars on the outside, parking garages and whatnot, but that neighborhood of 20,000 people, which isn't necessarily a small area, is going to be car free. And increasingly, I think that's where our cities are going, in the downtown areas, in our urban nodes, and even our town nodes, is thinking about how can we increase mobility versus how do we increase how we can have choices around the cars. And that I feel is the number one indicator, an increase in mobility.
But Lynn, a lot of companies, when they're thinking about, well, you know, if I'm going to do this deal, am I going to have parking? I want parking. I want surface parking. I want parking everywhere. Is it a culture change when working in economic development to change some of the expectations? Because if I'm, you know, I'm looking at the neighborhood of play in Rochester, where you'll find the strong Museum of Play. There's an expansion. It's near the filled eastern third of the Inner Loop. There's a lot of things happening there. But a big part of that early discussion was, well, is there going to be enough parking? Should we add parking? And I, you know, I understand why. I don't mean to mock that. If I were the owner of one of those properties, I might be asking the same questions. What do you say to the business owners who are always asking about parking, surface level parking, lots, et cetera?
I would say they're stuck in last century. GE, General Electric, just moved out of Stamford, Connecticut, and into Boston. There's not a lot of parking there, but they need creative, smart workers to make their businesses thrive. And those creative smart workers want to live in an interesting community, an interesting place, an interesting neighborhood, authentic, right? You have, what's that, John Deere just moved out of the hills of Iowa into Chicago for the same reason. Bell Atlanta in Georgia moved out of the suburbs into the cities. Across the board, there are dozens, hundreds of examples of how companies have left their suburban location and have relocated in a downtown area just because they need better access to workers. And now what's happening is a co-star, a real estate company, has their headquarters in D.C., and they opened up their research and development headquarters, not in D.C., but in Richmond, Virginia, for affordable housing. So the issue to me, that's what I would say to the business owners, is like, you guys are dealing with last century, because now, of course, a business is going to be located, if you have that choice, in a place that is vibrant and prosperous with a lot of activity, particularly of the 20, 30, 40-year-olds. And that's what the demographics want. And now it becomes, do you have affordable housing? And Rochester has that. You guys are primed just to explode right now.
Maria, you had a knowing smile at some of that answer. Why?
Well, because our first speaker, Gil Peñalosa, spoke about the fact that what you need to make places vibrant and to bring economic development are people, not cars. So when people are driving down the road, they're not necessarily accessing your business. They're going to a destination. So the most vibrant places are the places that you see crowds of people around, not crowds of cars.
All right, well, let me get a question from Jim in Irondequoit, who wants to know, how are parents supposed to get their children to the many different activities at the many different locations quickly and in a timely manner in the Rochester area? He's got three children. He sees this as a real challenge. Lynn?
Yeah, Jim, I'm right there with you. Yeah, we can have a beer and talking about this. So I can bike to work. I can bike to go get my groceries. But when my son has frisbee practice on the other side of Arlington, I have no choice but to get into the car, and it's driving me crazy. And so I think that's why I talk about transportation fluency. I think it is important for us to create communities where we have a choice on where and how to get around. So in Jim's case, and in my case, when I have to go pick up my son from frisbee, you may need the car. But if you structure all of your activities where you need a car, that's where we're falling by. And when I talk about mobility, right, that includes how you can bike, how you can walk, how you can take transit, how you can use, you know, Uber and Lyft. What is the wide range of opportunities there? But I could not, as a parent, go car free right now. But maybe in a couple of years I can, when I'm not having to do this pickup. So that's what I was saying. There's a nuance. Jim may very well be a Democrat, but right now he's got to go all over the city and the neighborhood to pick up his kids. Oh my gosh, it's exhausting, which I think is another question we should have with our school administrators. Can you make life a little bit easier for us parents, please? So Howard and Maria probably have much different answers to this.
Howard's ready to jump in. Go ahead, Howard.
I love the tone of Jim's question, you know, because he sounds kind of cranky. And really, what I want to do is get him even crabbier than he is now, because I want to say the answer to Jim's question is a car. That's the only way he can do what he wants to do now. If we can get him crabby enough, he's going to say, why in the hell do I have to get into my car to take my three kids to blank, wherever it is they have to go? And it's that absence of choice, plus the dawning realization that our cars are causing us some cataclysmic problems across the globe, that should motivate us to say, wait a minute, when we continue to build our city, what kind of a place do we want to make? We want to make a place where one of the choices is that people like Jim don't have to get into his damn car in order to get his kids to where they need to go. And he doesn't have that choice now. But he should have that choice. He must have
that
choice, and it's our job.
But the fields, like the damn sports fields, are spread out all across the different cities. When I was living in Cambridge, Massachusetts, it was easy as pie to use my tandem bike as the family station wagon because everything was in a 2 to 3 mile area, and I was able to do it. But as kids get older, I mean, that's where I absolutely agree with you that we have to get to a point where we're really mad. There's got to be another way, because that, as a parent, that's where I am. And this getting in the car every day goes so against my values. Yet it's the school. Like, can you please try to create, you know, more sports fields? Can we create a system where you're not relying on parents to do all of the schlepping? I think it's more than just the physical design of our communities, as it's more how we program where and how kids are raised. We've completely have shredded that idea, I believe.
I think it's a little bit like that scene in Network where the guy says, "I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore." And that's how we all need to get mad as hell, so we're not going to take it anymore. But really, the Congress for New Urbanism has so many teachable moments to share with us where they can say, as Lynn has just said, there's a place in Cambridge where the play fields are arranged in such a way that I don't have to get my kids, pick up my kids from baseball or frisbee or whatever it happens to be in my car. I can do it on my bicycle, or we can walk.
Or you can have transit.
Or imagine there's transit that Nearby. So it's those kinds of small moments that we need to increasingly learn about and hang on to and grasp as a kind of roadmap for our future.
I got to wrap up here. I want to tell our listeners, I'm going to sort of blow Howard's cover here. Listeners will be surprised. You are actually a lovely, optimistic person, I would say.
Well, thank you. That's very kind.
For all the listeners who think that like you're this proud curmudgeon, you're not even really a curmudgeon. You're actually quite lovely.
I verge on the curmudgeonly, but thank you.
I think you just, you know, sort of wear that. But you're sort of a happy warrior, I think, in New Urbanism. I just want to put it out there for Howard. If you ever meet Howard, he's quite a happy guy. Despite all of the obstacles to New Urbanism. And Maria Fergiuelli, as we wrap the program real quick, next week, 1 week from today, what's going on?
We've got the luncheon at the Memorial Art Gallery, noon, next Wednesday, the 22nd. We'd love to have you there.
May 22nd, rrcdc.org. That's the Rochester Regional Community Design Center's website, the Reshaping Rochester series. Tickets there. Thanks for being here, Maria.
Thank you.
And Howard, our favorite curmudgeon.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Lynn Richards, President and CEO of the Congress for New Urbanism. We'll see you back in your native Rochester in a week, and thank you so much for the hour.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Richards joining us, and she will be here as a guest of the Community Design Center next week. All right, our thanks to all the people involved with the program today, Don McDonald and Gary Putup behind the glass, and Megan Mack, producing and engineering. I'm Evan Dawson. Talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.